camp because I was right. So I don't get that, but I think this whole episode is so sad because here's a man that's wrenched with helplessness. You know, if it's you that's suffering, that's one thing. But when it's somebody you love, when it's your child, and you're powerless, some of you know that feeling. It's the worst feeling in the world. And then you come to bring him to Jesus. I think the whole nature of this whole narrative is that this guy didn't know Jesus. He didn't even really have very much faith in Jesus. Maybe he just heard. He's tried everything else. Maybe, you know, try this guy. This Nazarene, maybe this carpenter. You know, I hear rumors. But the pathetic thing is, Jesus wasn't available, so he went to his disciples. And they couldn't do anything. I brought you my son. You weren't around. So I asked your followers, I asked the guys that are your representatives, I asked the guys that represent you. And they couldn't do anything. I always tell people, go straight to Jesus. Cut out the middleman. You know, you have just as free access to him as I do, as any minister does. Go to him first. Call out to him like that scripture that Wayne read. Cut out the middleman because you never know. God's ministers still many times are obstacles to people being able to get to Jesus' power. I don't want to be. I endeavor to not be. The fact is that often we are. And there's a lot about that. I think the frustration, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The frustration of Jesus here is, it's touching. And there's some question as to who in verse is it, 19, who he's talking to. Oh, unbelieving generation. There's that Greek word genea or genea again, which is the word for a group of people with a common viewpoint or a common issue that unites them. And it can be a biological group or it could be a lynch mob or political party. It's a broad word in Greek. So who's he talking about when he talks about the unbelieving generation? By the way, the word unbelieving, that adjective has at its root the same root. It's the negative form of the root of the word for believe, which is the word pistuo, P-I-S-T-U-T-E-U-O, pistuo. And it's various forms of it are used throughout this narrative, so maybe it's a good idea if we just define that in case you don't know what it means. It's the English words that are translated from this Greek verb, pistuo, mean to believe, to trust, to have faith. All of the synonyms are a good way to get the definition of the word. The best definition that I've seen is from the Amplified Bible because it's so fat. It says it means to trust in, to rely upon, to cling to lean one's full weight upon God. To trust in him, to rely upon him. So when you see someone who is unbelieving, it means they're not trusting in God. They're not leaning on him. They're not relying upon him. And Jesus says, in a nutshell, that was the reason why the disciples, when they asked him later, why couldn't we do this? He said, because you weren't leaning on me. You weren't trusting in me. So here he calls a whole generation. Who's he talking about? Is he talking about the disciples? That's a possibility. Is he talking about the nine that had already had success doing this, but now they're, you know, they can't pray their way out of a wet paper bag? Is that who he's talking to? Or is he talking to all the religious leaders of Israel that just know how to argue doctrine? Here's a guy that needs God's power. And all they want to do is argue doctrine. Could he be talking about them? That's possible too. Could he be talking about the whole nation that was so estranged from God and God's power that demonic forces could come in and possess their children? I think that's possible. It could be all of those things. I do think it's interesting that Jesus had already given his disciples the authority over Satan to set people free. He given them the power to do it. And here they couldn't. Could it be as simple as the fact that they had no power to offer to set this person free because they were arguing their point of view with one another? Could it be as simple as that? Absolutely. I'm not thinking of anybody in particular, but I have seen this happen in marriages, in families. There's such a, you know, a contest. There's such a power struggle that the children don't have any opportunity to have solid leadership or access to the power of God, even when their parents are Christians. Because it's all about being right. Somebody told me when I used to be that way, a crusader, a very kind friend who had a way of saying irritating things to me that were always right. That's why they were so irritating. He said, Bob, you've got a choice. You can have the ministry of being right, or you can have the ministry of being with Jesus and filled with Jesus. And he said, if you want to have the ministry of being right, at the end of your life, you can stand on this big pile of dead bodies that you wiped out, and the devil will give you a standing ovation because of all the work you saved him. But it's so easy to get sucked into it, isn't it? Could it be the whole reason there was no power available for this child to be set free, no hope for the father? Could it be that the father's weak faith, even when he looked at Jesus, was simply because the disciples didn't have any faith? They were distracted. That's a very poignant question, isn't it? That's sobering, embarrassing to me. Could it be that people who watch our lives, who work with us, who are in our own families, could it be the reason they don't reach out to God's power is because we're supposed to know him and we don't trust in him, cling to him, rely upon him? We're so easily derailed. Oh, we love to argue about how right we are. We just don't have any power to offer anybody. Could it be that simple? Could it be that this man couldn't believe because Jesus' disciples didn't believe? I think that's worth examining. So the Spirit saw Jesus and immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. What's up with that? One word, blowfish. You know what a blowfish is? If you see a blowfish when he's not in danger, he's just looks like the, you know, any medium-sized trout could just gulp him down in one swallow. But when he knows he's in danger, he inflates himself. I don't know how many times, maybe 20 times his size, and little spiky things stick out. And it's sending out this neon message, you don't want to eat me. First of all, I'm so big you couldn't swallow me, and even if you did, it would hurt all the way down. And that's his strong self-defense mechanism. Here's a little glimpse into how often the enemy gets away with intimidation simply because he does the blowfish thing. And we get scared and we give up. And that's all he wants. In a hand-to-hand combat with somebody filled with the Holy Spirit, he would lose. But often it doesn't get that far because he does the blowfish thing. Happens to me all the time. Whenever I start thinking, I am the wrong person to be here, why didn't you send me someplace else? You know, nobody wants to hear what I have to say. There's so much darkness, you know, what's the good of turning the light? Whenever I'm thinking those kind of thoughts, just think blowfish. The enemy's puffed himself up. I read some statistic in Portland Press Herald this last week that Maine has 8 times the national average of addiction to pain killers. 8 times. I knew we led the nation in a lot of really icky statistics. We also lead the nation in one of the smallest percentages of people who attend church. There's maybe possibly a connection there somewhere. But when I look at me and who I am, and what I'm able to do, which seems so feeble, and then the blowfish puffs himself up bigger and bigger. Bird, you see where that's going? That's to get you to turn and swim away. That's the devil saying, you couldn't hit the broadside of a barn with those prayers, so what do you think you're doing praying? Who do you think you are? And he's only saying that because he's out of bullets. He's hiding in his little foxhole. He says, you know, throw down your weapons because you'll never hit anything. We'll go, okay. And we stop praying. We stop being a light because we think there's just so much darkness here. Hello? Remember high school physics? Remember that the bigger, we did this in my high school. We went into the gymnasium when we were illustrating this principle. Actually, when you have a small light, the larger area of darkness you have, the more visible that little light is. So all the darkness in the world isn't going to extinguish the light. Remember in John it said that, in John's gospel? It's not possible. So the devil does the blowfish thing. Always worked before. I wonder if he did that, and that's why if the disciples got afraid. I have to be honest with you. I've seen demonic possession. It's frightening. And I was just an observer. I wasn't the guy that was called upon to make it stop. Maybe that's what it was about. Maybe this looked like a bigger blowfish than they'd ever seen, and they were just afraid. Maybe that was his deal. Maybe that's the demon's deal. Just intimidate everybody and they'll go away. Satan does exaggerate his power. And who was it? It might have been Spurgeon or somebody like that that said he only has 3 plays in his playbook. He doesn't need very many because they work. He'll just keep doing the same 3 things because they work. And you'll keep doing it until they don't work anymore. I do find that the testimony here is so sad but it gives you a clue as to Satan's agenda. We saw it with the man in the tombs, remember? To isolate, to enslave, self-mutilation, isolation, fear. Bob Bennett's song, The Man of the Tomb, said, like those who fear me, I'm afraid. I'm afraid of myself. That's Satan's deal. Here he throws the kid into the fire. He tries to kill him. Remember Jesus said, Jesus' assessment of Satan is that he was a murderer from the beginning. No respect for human life at all. Makes me so sad that this guy came to Jesus and all he could find was supposedly God's representatives too busy arguing to be able to do anything about his problem. So when he approaches Jesus, oh, you're him? He says, well, if you can do anything, would you please have mercy? There is a little bit of a linguistic difficulty in verse 23. It has to do with English translations of the Greek phrase. I checked with Fred, who comes always prepared with his Greek Bible, which is keeps me on my toes. The NIV correctly renders this, and several of the newer translations do, and the older ones do not. Literally, when the man says, if you can do anything, Jesus' response is, if you can. It's a Greek idiom. It has a definite article in front of it in the Greek text. That's like saying that. It's like a, I'll just read you what Vincent said about it. It's like a finger pointing to a set of brackets. There's a Greek idiom here which cannot be brought over into the translation in English. A definite article occurs before the words, if you can. It acts like an index finger and a pair of brackets holding up to this Father his own words for his consideration. And Jesus comments, it's like Jesus is saying, if you can, you know that if you can you just said? And he corrects that by saying, everything is possible to the one who truly, and there's that word pistuo, trusts in, relies on, clings to, leans upon God. So the real issue Jesus is saying is not if I have the ability. That's what the word can means, if you're able. That wasn't the issue. Yes, of course. In fact, this could have happened before with you and your son or any one of these so-called religious people that are standing here arguing. If they were truly relying upon and leaning upon and trusting in the power of God, anything would have been possible. And that begs the question again, doesn't it? Are we the source of the lack of faith of the people in our lives? Is the reason our kids don't trust God because they watch us and we don't trust God? We act like we're orphans. The way we worry about stuff, and then we're telling them to trust God. This is the thing that Pastor Chuck told me when I was first ordained in 1978. He said, you have to realize something, Bob. This is not a fun job. He said, being a pastor means you are willing to be taught in front of everybody else. That means you're not going to look good a lot of the time if you're doing it right. You're going to have to be transparent so that people can watch what it looks like for a regular old human who doesn't trust God, who's self-centered, and who is a worrywart, for that person to be transformed into somebody that lives for Jesus and trusts him. Could it be that this man didn't have any faith that Jesus could even fix anything simply because of the way the disciples were? I think that definitely has to be considered. Let's look at this statement. We've entitled our study today, True Faith Sets No Limits. This is, God's been challenging me. He's been challenging me pretty much my whole life with this. It was worse when I was totally imprisoned by fear and worry. There's a commercial on TV now, I don't know if you've seen it, about a dog who his bone is sitting right next to his bed, but he starts worrying and he's going through a little doggy trauma. And so he takes his bone out and he buries it in the yard. And then he goes back and you see him tossing and turning in his little doggy bed and he's thinking, what is that? So he goes and he digs it up and he takes it to a bank. And then he's laying there and he's tossing and turning and he doesn't trust the bank. So he goes and he gets it out of the bank. And I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, that is the old me. That is the perfect description of the way I lived a lot of my life. But here's the deal. Even now that I'm not in bondage to that, I still find myself limiting the Lord and the one in my faith. And I find he's the one trying to talk me out of that. Every once a month when we have our prayer time here, where certain of us get together to just pray for the needs of the body, do the same thing on Tuesday up in Rockland. Once a month. Every time we get together to pray before the service on Sunday, every time he tells me the same thing. He says, Bob, I'm listening. I'm going to hear everything you say. Do not limit me. If you're going to ask me to do something, believe that I can. That, in theory, is easy to do. It's especially easy to lecture other people about doing it. But all of us have our certain panic button subjects, don't we? This is why I love this guy's prayer to Jesus. Jesus says, hey, hey, if you can, if I can do it, hey, you don't get it. If you had any trust in cling to and relying upon, leaning upon the power of God, there would be no limit. You wouldn't set those kind of limits if you trusted in God. And I just love the next word. It says, the Father exclaimed. It's the Greek word. I'm going to read you what the Amplified Bible says because I think it's so powerful. It says, eager, inarticulate cry with tears. He just burst out saying, I am believing, but help my weak faith, my unbelief. And that verb tense in Greek is continuous action. So he says, I am believing, but constantly be helping my weak faith. True faith sets no limits, so that when I'm setting limits, it's just because I don't truly, I either don't know him yet. Another one I think that limits our prayers is we don't know his heart. We know he's got the ability, but we think, why would he waste his time with me? I'm nothing. So knowing God's heart, knowing God's power, knowing his ways, those are very, very important things, which is why we spend so much time studying it. Something Pastor Chuck said that really helped me. Because in the Worrywart days especially, I had certain categories of things that I thought were my responsibility, and certain categories of things that were God's responsibility, and certain categories of things that were just out there. They're just, oh, we wouldn't bother praying for that. There's that poignant phrase in Scripture that says that Israel limited the Holy One of Israel by their unbelief. God had a lot of stuff he wanted to do. They just didn't ask him. When they did ask him, it wasn't with faith. We studied that in James a few weeks ago, that we just didn't call on him. We just handled it ourselves, or we chalked it up to, well, I can't expect God to be involved there. Here's what Pastor Chuck said that stuck in my mind. I just pass it on to you. The difficulty of any task should be measured by the ability of the person who is going to actually do the work. So when I need $5, that's no big deal for me to pray for. What if I need $50,000? I pray completely differently. There was a time in my life I needed $50,000. Not just that I wanted it to buy a new car. I needed it. I was in big trouble if I didn't get it. My prayers were totally different. Why? It's obvious. $50,000, man, that's a big deal. Well, to whom? Is it a big deal to God? Well, technically, no. No, technically, no, 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 no. If God's the one that's going to be doing the work, why should there be any limit to what I pray for? I just love the way children are and new believers are on this issue. Somebody told them that God could do anything, and they believed it. And so they, when they pray, that's what they pray. They pray believing that God can. Now, it's a different issue than ordering him around, that I can make him do what I want him to do. That's not what's at stake here. What's at stake here in this text is the ability. If you are able. And Jesus says, what do you mean, if you're able? Everything is possible. Interesting thing I found out this time. I didn't know it last time I taught this. But the word possible in my NIV, where Jesus said everything is possible to the one who trusts in, clings to, relies upon God's power. That's the same word as the word can or able. So the limit in the ability is who you're trusting in to do it.